Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
I want to begin our podcast today by giving a couple shout-outs to some folks who have been very supportive to us. As some of you know, we've just passed our 50th episode, which is certainly a milestone, and it's pretty hard to believe that I've been doing this for about a year. I'm first of all grateful to all the guests we've had on the show over the past year. For those of you who are new to the podcast series, I urge you to rummage back through our archives and see what you've missed. There is sure to be something in there, I think, for everybody. Second, I'd like to mention a few folks who have been directing a significant amount of traffic our way, most prominently LDS Living, also The Western Tradition, a classical and Christian blog, Michael McBride's The Religious Marketplace blog, and Bradley Wright's eponymous blog called Bradley Wright's Blog. I'm sure I missed a few folks there who have been steering new listeners our way, so my apologies if I didn't name you in specific. We're going to go ahead and link to all those folks' websites on our current website, so you can visit them and say hello and thank them for directing traffic here. And I'd also like to thank all the folks who are spreading word of us via Facebook. If you haven't done so already, please like us or friend us over Facebook so we can build a bigger following, especially if you like what you're hearing here. And finally, I have to give a big thanks to the folks at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion who had the courage to take a chance on this endeavor and have supported it wholeheartedly. This includes Byron Johnson and Rod Stark, the founders and co-directors of ISR, and the great support staff, including Francis Malone and Cameron Andrews. Also in the mix, and we can't forget him, is Neil Luft, who runs Internet Imagineering, the company that got our website up and running and is currently maintaining it. Again, we'll post links to all these places, so if you're interested, please visit them. And ISR is a great place if you're interested in the social scientific study of religion, because they have a number of interesting books, working papers, and policy reports that are both informative and accessible to the general public. All right, now on to our regularly scheduled program here. Today's podcast marks our first foray explicitly into the topic of Judaism. While we've touched on that subject a couple times as tangents in other episodes, this is our first full examination of that faith tradition. Specifically today, we want to examine Judaism in America, and I'm pleased to have with me Professor Carmel Chiswick, who is a professor emerita at the University of Illinois Chicago, as well as a research professor of economics at the George Washington University. Carmel has a very distinguished career, principally as a scholar studying economic development and labor in economics, but has also delved into the areas of economic demography, education, economic history, and immigration. And over the past two decades, she has also investigated the economics of religion with a specific focus on Judaism, often blending it with her interest in immigration, education, and labor studies. That entire mix has provided some very interesting insights into the history and progress of American Jews. So, Carmel, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you very much.
Now, we've had a number of other economists of religion on this show in the past year, and most folks outside of that somewhat narrow field of religious economies would find it odd that economists would study religion at all. So my first question to you is more of a personal question. What prompted your interest as an economist into studying Judaism?
Well, I was very much influenced by a professor of mine who, in graduate school, who insisted that economics is not a subject, it's a discipline. It's a set of tools. And you can study any subject that you want from an economic perspective. The question is, how is behavior in that area influenced by prices and incomes? So I never felt that religion was something that couldn't be studied. And when Larry Iannacone came by with his path-breaking work on the subject, I thought, gee, you know, this is really cool stuff. So I began thinking, just in the back of my mind, in my own life, about the value of time and how that was affecting my behavior in many areas, including religion. And then I came into a situation where I realized that there were a lot of people around me, in my Jewish community specifically, that weren't aware that the value of time was a legitimate cost that they could factor in when they're deciding if they could afford something. And yet their behavior reflected that kind of thinking. People always say, we can't afford the time, or we don't want to waste the time, or that isn't worth my time. But they didn't have the tools to recognize that that was a legitimate budget decision.
Mm-hmm.
So I started explaining it to my fellow parents at the school, and sometimes to the teachers, and sometimes to people that I was on committees with. And I just decided at some point I better write this up, because everybody could appreciate how insightful it is and how legitimizing it is when you worry about time as though it were a legitimate budget constraint.
I think that's a really important concept right there, because I know students have a lot of problems with that as well. When I teach my Intro to Political Economy course, they think it's all going to be about money. Very specifically. And I think economists focus on money quite a bit because it's the easiest measure we have of utility. But there's other types of resources that are scarce that we have to maximize and make trade-offs with. And as you mentioned, time is one of these. And it factors really importantly into the study of religion here.
That's right. And in labor economics, we learned that a simple rule of thumb that works very well for evaluating the value of time is your wage rate. It's how much you could earn if you worked for another hour, or, you know, one can extrapolate another month, another year. And your hourly wage rate is a pretty good proxy for how you value your time in all activities, not just in work activities. And I won't take the time here to explain why that is, but it's a third of a lecture. Mm-hmm. In labor economics that we do all the time.
Yeah.
So the American Jewish community as a group is very well educated, and being well educated means that you are in high-level jobs. You're in professional jobs or your managerial jobs, the jobs that we consider high-level manpower. And because it's a highly educated community, its members have a high value of time, and that's a simple generalization that we can make. And it has implications for our religion, our religious institutions, and our religious behavior, because time is a very binding constraint for most Jewish families.
Let's go ahead and explore that a little bit further. And I want to take this back historically, because you've done a lot of really interesting research on how the Jewish community has progressed here as immigrants in the United States over the past 150, 200 years. And you recently wrote a chapter entitled How Economics Helped Shape American Judaism, which pulls together a lot of what we're talking about here, including issues of education, labor, time, and immigration. So let's go ahead and start this story, because it has this nice chronological path to it that we can pick up a lot of economic concepts along the way. And so I think it's best that we probably start out by documenting Jewish immigration into the United States, when it happened and from where it was coming, along with the socioeconomic context that Jews were stepping into when they arrived in America. What did America look like when they essentially got off the boat?
Well, actually, we've just celebrated a couple years ago 350 years of Jewish presence in what is now the United States. The first Jews came from, they were Hispanic Jews, and they came from Spain by way of Brazil, which was at that time actually Portugal. And they landed in New York, and of course that was when it was New Amsterdam. And they founded their own communities, and they had struggles just being acknowledged as full citizens of the colony because they were not Christians, and that was their big issue. And that issue actually was an important one for the Jewish community up until the 1800s, the early 1800s, when all the states did give Jews the right to serve in their legislatures. But in the middle of the 19th century, there was a wave of immigrants from Germany and German-speaking empire, and they greatly outnumbered the existing Jewish community. So we think of 19th century Jewry as German and German-speaking,
mm-hmm.
and we refer to the German Jews, and that's part of our heritage. The German Jews came. They were peddlers in Germany, and they were peddlers when they came to the United States. They roamed all over the country as itinerant peddlers, but their community was centered in the East Coast cities. And but they would move their way up the economic ladder, settling all over the place. In their wanderings as peddlers, they would find places that they thought were good to settle in. And so they were all over the frontier, which at that time was pretty much east of the Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
and eventually became department stores whose names we recognize, and we think of them as merchants. But then at the later decades of the 19th century, in the 1880s, began a big influx of Jews from what was then called Russia. It was the Tsarist Empire. And it included Russia and much of Eastern Europe. They were Yiddish-speaking rather than German-speaking, and they came in such large numbers that they overwhelmed the numerically the German Jewish community. And so, as late as the 1990s, something like 95% of American Jews were the descendants of immigrants that came during that big wave from Russia between 1880 and 1917. And it was that immigrant experience that dominated 20th century Judaism in the United States, and that is still today an important part of the American Jewish heritage.
Now, economically, this is really important to think about the timing of the immigrant wave that comes in here. And in your paper, you really make this clear, is that the late 1800s, or even if you want to include the German immigrants in there as well, and those are the Ashkenazi Jews,
yes.
Correct, as compared to the earlier wave of the Spanish, which would be Sephardic, yes. Right? And it's at that time that America is going through a major economic transformation from roughly yes. the mid-1800s to 1900s, the industrialization period. Why should this matter in terms of how things play out in America Judaism?
Well, it was an important period of immigration. It was a period of mass immigration from many, many places. There were so many Jews coming from Russia. Basically, at the beginning of the period, 90% of the world's Jews lived in Russia. By the end of that period, half of them lived in the United States.
No.
Well, I guess a third in the United States, but only half of them lived in Russia. So it was a massive immigration in the Jewish world, but in America, it was, you know, Jews have never been numerically important. It was at the peak, 10% of the immigrants were Jews from Russia, and a much smaller fraction of the population. But it dominated the American Jewish community. So from the very beginning, institutions were set up to deal with this huge influx of immigrants. They came with nothing but what was on their backs. Towards the end of the period, they had heard that there was work in the garment industry, and so the immigrants would sometimes arrive with garment industry skills and even carrying their sewing machines with them. But for the most part, they were unskilled labor. It was a time in our history when the factories were expanding their use of unskilled labor. So it was possible for unskilled workers to find factory jobs. And in fact, the Jews, of course, were not the only ones. The Italians and the Poles and the Ukrainians.
Don't forget the Irish. I'm Irish, and my family came
Irish
over around that
earlier.
Time.
The Irish came when the Germans came in the middle of the 19th century.
That's true. I'm thinking my own family. We traced it back to coming in the 1890s. So.
Okay. Well, I guess there were more Irish that came in the 1890s. There were also a lot of Americans who were coming from rural areas into the cities. And that was an important part of the movement as well. The cities were just absorbing like sponges all these immigrants, many of whom were unskilled. But part of the Industrial Revolution of the 80s, as distinct from the one that had happened 50 years earlier, was the beginning of the professions and science as a mover of technology. The progressive movement embodied that, and science was seen as the wave of the future. And in fact, that period was a huge demand for highly skilled technical workers and professional workers, and the supply was very limited. It was the period when the land-grant colleges were being expanded to fill that gap. And that was the world in which the Jews came. When they first arrived, they were all unskilled. But together with many other Americans, it was a time when college education would have a huge payoff. And the Jews sent their children to college, not always right away. They would keep them in school as long as they could. But by the end of the immigration period, there were enough Jews who were able to send their children to college. And I must say, as a footnote, there were very low-cost colleges to send them to, not only the land-grant colleges, but the City College in New York was another one.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews, even if they had to leave high school to work, they would then apply to college to go later. And by 1946, which is right after World War II, would be the time when the children of the immigrants were full adults, two-thirds of the Jewish men in America were in high-level occupations, which meant they either had professional degrees or they owned their own business. And I'm not talking about mom-and-pop businesses. They don't count. But they owned a business that they had started small and then built up. The legendary stories about this are in the garment industry, which the Jews were very important innovators in the structure of the industry and helped build that up. But Jews also found niches in new industries where other people hadn't gone yet. And the big one there is movies. They became very important in that industry. There were sort of miscellaneous industries here and there that were new, and the Jewish people, as individuals, recognized opportunity, went into it, and helped build up the industry from scratch and rose substantially.
I can imagine this is a typical story for immigrant groups seeking to assimilate. You come off the boat, you're in a new society, you do what you can at first to survive, but you're always looking for potential pathways to improve yourself and perhaps more importantly, the next generation.
Yes, and you are.
Yeah.
I thought about comparing and contrasting the Jews in this period with the other immigrant groups. And the one that always comes to mind are the Italians, because the Jews and the Italians lived in the same neighborhood and worked in the same industries. But I think something that's relevant here is education. In any immigrant family, there's always a balance that has to be reached between assimilating into the new country and preserving the traditions of the old country, and preserving your ethnic identity, as it will come to be known. And different immigrant groups found different balances between that. Some kept the ethnic identity much more strongly, and Jews did not. Jews wanted to assimilate into America. They came from a country, from a background, where Judaism was pretty much an ascribed trait. You could shake it. You were a Jew no matter what you did. You know, even if you converted to Christianity, you would be known as a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And so it never occurred to most of them, I believe, that they would stop being Jewish or that their children wouldn't be Jewish. And so they didn't see the value of worrying about traditional education. They did see the value of becoming Americans, which meant getting a secular education as much as possible. They did continue to practice Judaism in their own way, but they didn't put a high priority on it. They observed Jewish holidays, did not go to synagogue all that much, but they did establish synagogues, Jewish synagogues, Jewish burial societies, Jewish social clubs. So it's not like they rejected their religion, but they just didn't make it an important part of their life. The religious aspect wasn't important.
Yeah, that's interesting, and I want to question you on what you wrote, and this is on page 650 of the book chapter that we're looking at. You say that the immigrants overestimated the extent to which their children could learn Judaism by simply living among other Jews.
Yes.
And so is that part of the reason why there was less of an emphasis on the old traditional religious training as compared to new secular college education?
I think so. But I think also there was the times. It was a time in which modern people, and I'm putting that in quotes, viewed religion as superstition. Religion was not viewed as a good thing by many of the intellectual elite. The tradition that came out of the French Revolution, perhaps, it was part of European modernization. I mean, Europe became very, very secular in the 20th century. And the intellectual elites, the educated elites, became secular even faster. And this was a tradition that characterized a number of institutions in the United States, mostly the ones in Cambridge. At the beginning of this period, when the Jews are first starting to enter American colleges, most American colleges are associated with some religious institution. And separation of science and religion was the big intellectual push from the faculty.
Right.
One had required chapel 2 hours a day or whatever it was. And, you know, these land-grant colleges, many of them, that was a big issue, that faculty should not be required to be of a particular religion in order to teach there. And students should be free to practice their religion, and religion should not intrude upon the classroom secular subjects. So that was the sort of cultural context of that time, and the Jews just jumped right into it because that resonated with them. They didn't want to have to go to a Christian chapel for 2 hours a day or even half an hour a day. And they understood very clearly, because of their cultural experience, how to separate science from religion.
Right. I can understand how that would be in the case that Jews were a minority religion pretty much everywhere they've been in the past several centuries.
Yes.
And you come over here and the thinking of mom and dad are saying, well, you know, we'll send them to these land-grant colleges. That's the pathway to more prosperity here, science, technology. That's the career path we want to put our kids on. And they're going to stay Jewish because we stay Jewish. We're just in a Jewish community, and that's how it always was. We're labeled as that, and it's not going to change.
That's right.
Okay.
And there's also the secularism and the walking away from religion. I think Jews, the immigrants, are probably all immigrants, or many immigrants, are self-selected for people who do not particularly want, who find the religious community, their home religious community, to be constraining, and they wanted to break with it. Now, that's not the case for religious dissenters who come to the United States in order to be able to practice their religion. But most of the immigrants during that period were probably in the other category.
And that's what we typically find in sociology, is that one of the big predictors of people not having religion is their migration status. So up here in the Pacific Northwest, where there aren't that many people deeply attached to religious practice, it is largely when you look at regressions, I've done some research on this, it's largely effect of people who are mobile. They're not rooted back to their home cities where they grew up. They're wanderers, they're pioneers, and those are the folks that are not attached to religion in general.
That's right. The ones who are very attached to religious community are reluctant to leave it. You want to bring some of it with you. I mean, not all Jews are in this category, because when you have a massive migration, and really the migration out of Russia was more like a refugee, somewhere between a refugee movement and an economic migration.
Mm-hmm.
Leaving Russia was refugee movement. Choosing to come to the United States was an economic decision. Mm-hmm. But you had people of all ages, sort of disproportionately young. Mm-hmm. But that's an aspect of this movement that has always intrigued me, although it's beyond my area of expertise. You have a massive movement of young people, mainly, leaving their parents. Now, some of them were young families already, and others were still single and married when they got here. But basically, it was a community with very few grandparents.
Mm.
And that, because it was such a large community, and then because in the early decades of this immigration, people actually not only wrote back to their parents, but were able to visit their parents. But with the Russian Revolution, that avenue became broken after World War One, and then with the Holocaust, European Jewry was effectively destroyed, and the American immigrant community was bereft of its elder generation. We think of old Jews, we think of American-born grandparents or immigrants who became grandparents, but they themselves raised their families without grandparents.
That's absolutely fascinating. And I want to turn a little bit to how this transforms the religious life of Jews, because something happens importantly during this period of time. We're talking roughly the turn of the 20th century, give or take a few decades, that the Jewish religion in the United States starts bifurcating or splitting it into different groups, the Reform Judaism, Conservative Judaism, and then Orthodox. So tell us a little bit about what is happening with these movements that are splitting apart.
Well, Reform Judaism all these movements start in Europe. The 19th century is a period of intellectual ferment in Europe in many different religions, including Judaism. And it's, I think, associated with economic development in Europe. But let's just focus on the American side.
Okay.
The German immigrants who came mid-century brought some of the ideas of the Reform movement with them, but they were very American in terms of how they thought about it and how they developed it here. The key issue always is the value of time. Economic migrants go from a low-wage area to a high-wage area. That's what makes them economic migrants. And American wages were higher, especially for the people who actually moved, were higher than they had been in the old country. And that means that the value of their time was higher. Now, this is going to be even more so in the 20th century with the rapid economic development. But even as early as the 1840s and 50s, economic development is occurring. You have the Industrial Revolution and all kinds of moving, the frontier is moving west, all kinds of things going on. So wages are really going up, and they're going up to unprecedented levels. Like, at no time in history have working people had such high productivity and had such high consumption ability. So value of time is extremely high, and traditional services, traditional synagogue services, are very time intensive, because in the old country the value of time was very low for men, and so they would spend a lot of time in the synagogue. They would be their pleasure as well as an obligation. In America, they just can't afford to do that. Their time is too valuable, too many other things competing with religious service.
You run your business.
And they're losing the young people for that reason. So how do they deal with losing the young people? Well, they make the synagogue service more appealing. They shorten it, for one thing. The young people, one of the most time-intensive demands of Jewish religious training is learning the Hebrew language. And for the synagogue purpose, one's not even learning what we now consider modern Hebrew, but one's learning classical Hebrew. It was sort of really comparable to learning Greek and Latin in the universities. And so if you don't have to study Hebrew intensely, then that saves a lot of time.
You could be studying engineering, biology, business.
So in the early days of the Reform movement in the United States, the synagogue services were, in the vernacular, meant talking in German in the synagogue. Mm-hmm. But that quickly changed to English because the young people didn't know German. And that was really the big thing. Now, the other things that the Reform movement broke with were dietary restrictions. Mm-hmm. It was very difficult to observe them in the United States if you were going to socialize with friends and business colleagues who were not Jewish, because then you couldn't eat with them. And so, for the most part, that was a big break.
Actually, I want to stop right there, because this is interesting. I think there's a subcomponent to this that really plays out as the Jewish community becomes wealthier and is inserted into more of the professional jobs that are out there, such as lawyers and business people, etc., is that when you come over, when immigrants come over, they typically try to find their old country somewhere in a city. You find yourself in a ghetto, etc. But then as you become more successful, you have the monetary resources to find a nicer place to live. And during this period of time, too, especially in the early 20th century, transportation costs are dropping quite rapidly. So you can move a little bit farther out. And if you're a minority community moving out into a majority Christian area, the more you move out, the more dispersed you're going to get. So the points of contact you have are going to be less likely to be your neighboring Jews, but more likely to be Christians.
That's right.
And so, you know, in terms of making business contacts and at the university that you're in, you're meeting with a number of Christians, you want to associate in these circles because networking is important to your, you know, future professional development. And somebody comes over and says, well, we're having a meal tonight. You ask if it's kosher, and now all of a sudden you're in a position of, well, if it's not kosher, then I cannot associate with that group. So that becomes pretty difficult.
Yes, it does. And this is a problem that Jews have had throughout history. This is not new to America. We see that this was an issue, you know, 1,500 years ago.
But is there something interesting about the American case, that my image of Europe is that Jews were kept in the ghetto, that there were restrictions, either legal restrictions or very stark cultural restrictions placed upon Jews that made it difficult to expand, whereas in the United States it's much more free, mobile, and open?
These things come and go.
Okay.
The legal restrictions were sometimes enforced, sometimes not. You know, Jews tended to cluster in Jewish neighborhoods or Jewish villages, in part for the same reason that we develop ethnic neighborhoods in our cities. You know, you want to be walking distance from your synagogue, you want to be at a place where you can buy kosher food, and you want to be with people that have a common, I was going to say social life, but just the holiday celebrations.
Yeah.
Right? It's nicer to do it in a group than it is to do it all by yourself. So there's always this incentive to live in a place where you're within shouting distance of other Jews. In America, what happened was that the earlier immigrant generation might have dispersed, but then, you know, when the children get older and you're beginning to think about they should meet other young people, and you're beginning to think in those terms. People often moved from the boondocks back into a city that had a Jewish community. And there were Jewish communities in many American cities. In the 19th century, you know, it was Charleston and New Orleans and Philadelphia and Baltimore, as well as New York and Boston. In the German community in Cincinnati, Minneapolis had a big Jewish, you know, and we're talking about big, we're talking about anything over 5,000 families.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the late, you know, with the big Russian immigration, the huge settlement was in New York, of course. But there was also a big Jewish enclave in Chicago and Buffalo and, you know, around, can I say. So it is helpful to live near other Jews. But even if you live in a Jewish community, you work
mm-hmm.
in a place where there are non-Jews. And the dietary laws are among the first to go, especially for the Reform, but also for the others. The big cost of observing the dietary laws is the social cost, as you mentioned. But there's also the problem of, you know, before the time when meat could be refrigerated, you had to have a kosher butcher in town in order to eat kosher meat. And very few places had that.
Yeah.
So that was another reason. But I guess there are all kinds of theological underpinnings that the Reform movement came up with for these changes, and which are well documented. But from a point of view of economics, economics didn't determine the theology, but it did determine how popular it was going to be. Mm-hmm. If it's a lot cheaper to be a Reform Jew than it is to be an Orthodox Jew, then you're going to have a larger demand for the Reform than you are for the Orthodox. It has to do with downward sloping demand curves. And that is it's the high value of time and the high cost of observing the dietary laws that really made the Reform movement as popular as it was. However, having said this, in the 18, when the Reform movement actually set up its own seminary and started training rabbis with their theology and their approach to Judaism, they went too far for most American Jews who were not ready to break that severely with tradition.
Is this where you get the difference between Reform and conservative Judaism?
Yes.
Okay.
At first, that break is between the Reform and non-Reform, the Reform and everybody else.
Right.
And then later in the early 20th century, Orthodoxy splits off from conservative because there were some matters of dogma. Basically, the conservative wasn't conservative enough for them. Right? So they broke off and formed their own movement.
How would you characterize the difference between Reform Judaism and conservative Judaism for those listeners who might not be familiar with those tendencies?
Well, there are various ways one can do it. From a theological point of view, there's always been in the Jewish tradition a body of Jewish law, and there have been rabbinic courts that rule on cases people bring to it having to do with Jewish law. And the question is, how binding are these cases, are these decisions? And basically, the Reform movement did away with that whole system of religious courts, and the conservative movement did not, which means that the conservative movement accepts as binding the rulings of the rabbinic courts. Now, that doesn't mean that individual conservative Jews accept them as binding. But from a theoretical point of view, that's a fundamental break between the two. In terms of practice, there really isn't a whole lot of difference nowadays. There was early in the 20th century when the reform movement rejected the dietary laws. They even had synagogue services on Sunday and called their rabbis reverend. They adopted a lot of practices that seemed to the new immigrants to be very Christian. But that really changed. I mean, reform movement, the pendulum swung back to much closer to tradition. And since World War II, really, especially in small towns where there's a small Jewish community, there hasn't been a whole lot of difference between the actual behavior of the Reform and Conservative synagogues. And if the community is too small to support two synagogues, it seems to be 50-50 as to whether it'll be Reform or Conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody goes there. So there isn't a whole lot of difference. The Conservative movement generally emphasizes Jewish learning more than the Reform. But in recent decades, the Reform movement has moved over in that respect as well. There was a time during the 1940s and even into the 50s when the conservative movement was very, very supportive of a Jewish state in Israel, establishing it and supporting it in its early days. And the Reform movement didn't like that idea because they claimed a part of their theology was that we've been waiting too long for a Jewish to return to Zion. This is, you know, 1,800 years is enough. Jerusalem is an imaginary place as a euphemism for paradise, and we don't need to go back there. But that has definitely changed. That changed. I'm not sure how popular it ever was, but it definitely changed in terms of the Reform dogma by 1950.
Changed in what direction?
The Reform is very Zionist.
Okay.
Very, very Zionist. That used to be something that differentiated conservative and Reform, but for the last 50 years, it has not been.
I guess when Israel becomes a reality, then that argument of, oh, we've waited for 1,800 years, it's not going to happen, doesn't wash very much.
The reality of Israel has had tremendous impact on American Judaism. And one can find economic underpinnings for this as well. Generally, once again, the economics doesn't determine it. It reinforces it.
Mm-hmm.
Just something simple like Hebrew is the language of Judaism, of religious Judaism. Having a country in which Hebrew is the native language means that it's much easier to find Hebrew teachers for your schools. It's a place where you can go to learn the language and then come back and bring it into your American community.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have a certain level of the language skill, which is much cheaper to learn in Israel than it is to learn here as a foreign language, then once you have that skill, that makes you a more productive consumer of Jewish religious life in every respect. So that actually has been a huge change.
Mm-hmm. It makes you more productive in terms of your religious experience, learning
yes.
Hebrew and such. But one of the strands of research that you've worked on is the issue of religious education and to what extent it's a substitute for secular education, to what extent it's a complement of it. Now, earlier on in the podcast here, we talked about how it was a substitute when you had the immigrant families deciding, okay, do we send our kids to study Hebrew and, you know, really focus on religious education, or we send them to the land-grant universities and say, hey, go study engineering.
Yeah.
It's engineering wins out, and that's a substitution effect. You only have 24 hours in the day. There's time cost here. You can spend on engineering or Hebrew, go the engineering route. But you've also investigated the possibility to what extent studying Hebrew and other traditional Jewish teachings or theology can have a complementary effect on one's secular education. And for me, this is kind of interesting because my son is learning Latin right now. And he says, Dad, what am I ever going to use Latin for? I said, well, you can go talk to Latin Americans. But he's smart enough to know they don't talk Latin there either. But so I need an argument to help me tell him that learning Latin is okay. So,
well, what they told me when I was his age is that if you learn Latin, it's easy to pick up the other Romance languages.
Yeah, that's what they tell him too. So.
And you get a bigger English vocabulary.
And I guess that goes to the issue of the complementarity of religious education. What have you found there in terms of, is religious education a complement to secular education?
Well, I think in some respects, it is. The immigrant generation came from a background in which religious culture was very much based in Talmud. And Talmud is a very, very interesting compilation of documents. It is what you get when you study Talmud, apart from the substance of the cases that it's deciding, is how to investigate a problem and look at the pros and cons of the different issues and extract from them a decision that takes into account the pros and cons.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, it's an investigative method that's very, very similar to the scientific method. And it teaches the principle that not every problem has a solution, but it is the quest for an answer which is important, and that some problems do have solutions. It also gives you is based on a principle that what matters is the intellectual discourse, not the actual person. You cite other people who come up with arguments that you're discussing, but they don't have to be in the same room with you. I mean, there's no politics involved in this kind of discourse. It's all the merits of the case.
Mm-hmm.
And these concepts are very, very helpful when you go to higher education in American universities. You are not learning by rote when you study Talmud. You're learning how to think. You can almost think of it as a manual as to how to approach problems and how to think about them. And it instills respect for teachers, but not unquestioning.
Yeah, not unquestioning loyalty and that which I strive for in my students, by the way. They need that unquestioning loyalty.
We all do.
Yeah.
Well, I think even though the immigrants who actually came were not Talmud scholars, for the most part, and not even particularly well-educated, they came from a culture in which these attitudes permeated. And that, I think, was really important. That's why they did well in school. It's learning how to learn is the hard part.
Well, there's something interesting that you mentioned in your work as well, is that early on, or I should say around the turn of the 20th century, many of the rabbis that were in the United States were not from the United States themselves, since, again, you have that substitution effect between religious education and secular education. The secular path was much more promising toward, you know, wealth, assimilation, etc. And so most of the rabbis were actually imported from Europe.
That's right. Not just the rabbis. Rabbis, cantors, kosher butchers, people who could perform circumcisions. There are a number of technical skills that are required for a Jewish community. And we just never, in this country, the immigrants never set up training institutes for this because, you know, first of all, you could always go back to the old country. The old country, there were some important, we call them yeshivas. There were important yeshivas in Eastern Europe and even in some places in Western Europe that were already training these people. And they were, you know, first-rate educational institutions, and we just, there was no point in setting them up in the United States. On the other hand, as economic circumstances of the Jews of Europe became more and more constrained and more difficult, these yeshivas were just turning out all these specialists who no longer had a community to serve because the community was moving to America.
Mm-hmm.
So the Americans hired them. Instead of setting up their own seminaries, they hired the products of these European seminaries. And Americans also supported the European seminaries. They sent money to them as part of their charitable support system, and then they hired their graduates. This worked just fine until the Holocaust.
Okay, that was my next question. Has this changed over time or over the course of the 20th century?
Well, the first big change came with the establishment of the Reform Seminary in Cincinnati in the 1880s, because that really, the Reform Judaism was not what the European yeshivas were training rabbis to lead.
Right.
So that was one break. But the other really was the destruction of European Jewry. That was devastating on many fronts and from many perspectives. But from the economic perspective, what it meant was there was no longer a bastion of tradition.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to rebel if you have something to rebel against.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Teenagers always have their parents that they can rebel against. But if you don't have a parent when you're a teenager, then you're less likely to be rebellious because you can't afford it. And that's pretty much what happened in American Jewry. It sort of caught us up short that we could rebel against tradition as long as we knew that there was a tradition to rebel against.
Mm-hmm.
But once that was gone, you realize that if we didn't do it here, it would be lost forever. And that was a big wake-up moment, a big change in American Jewry. That's when American Jewry began taking very seriously the importance of traditional rabbinic training and traditional religious activities.
I want to investigate this in light, too, of what Larry Iannacone's work on sacrifice and stigma, mm-hmm. And dating back to Dean Kelly's work on why strict churches tend to be rather strong. And the issue of Reform Judaism going back into the 1800s, trying to become more cost-effective, so to speak, with the surrounding culture around it. When Dean Kelly looked at this in terms of Christian churches, and Larry Iannacone has done this as well with Christian churches, we find out that the assimilation to the culture around lowers the cost of the culture around there, but it has a pretty significant impact on the religious attendance or religious practice of members within those communities here. Has Reform Judaism experience the same kind of tendencies? And I'm starting to think about issues such as intermarriage. And you know, I went to school at UCLA, and I know the Jewish communities around UCLA at the time were very, very concerned in the 1980s about intermarriage. And they had singles nights and et cetera, et cetera. But I'm sure there's a number of other dimensions where, you know, Reform Judaism might not be inspiring as much religious participation and fervor to keep the movement going as it might have. So what were your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, it's interesting because the early Reform movement was using Kelly's terminology, very exclusivist. I mean, it may have seemed to traditional Jews as though it was just a copying American Protestantism, but they were very dogmatic. And that is definitely relaxed over the century. And to a large extent, it is today's Reform movement is very much towards the ecumenical scale on Kelly's continuum. You know, if religious behavior is very general, and you don't have a very strong religious attachment in your life, then marrying somebody of another religion who's also in the same situation. This intermarriage happens not only because Jews are have a low priority on religion when they're selecting a marriage partner, but it's because there are marriage partners out there who are willing to marry Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And that means not only that there's less anti-Semitism, but also that these are people who have broken with their own religion or are very relaxed about the importance of their own religion. So what you have is basically two secular people marrying each other who are nominally of different religions, but de facto are pretty non-religious or secular. I think in the case of Jews, I think this happened a generation ago. I think that many of the children of Jewish immigrants were in that category. They married other Jews because they lived in Jewish enclaves. They met other Jews, and there weren't that many other non-Jewish Americans with the same education level and the same intellectual interests. But once the rest of America caught up with the Jews, so to speak, the Italians achieved in three generations what the Jews did in one generation, but now the Italians are just as educated as the Jews, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are partners out there. There are people who have a lot in common with Jews who are not Jewish. I think the intermarriage didn't happen earlier because of strong ethnic identities rather than religious identities. And as those dissipate, then we're seeing intermarriage in large numbers.
Mm-hmm. Let me go ahead and ask about the Chabad movement. And
okay.
I'm fascinated about this because I'm working with an undergraduate on a project of how the reduction in transportation costs have affected American Judaism. And we talk about the conservative Judaism back in the 1950s deciding to allow people to drive to shul, and you know that's okay, and that might have impacts, and that people start moving farther and farther out. And you're dealing with a minority community here that is roughly 2%, give or take a little bit, of the American population. And as they start to move out and move away from the religion, it's not very cost effective to plant synagogues where they go because they're more dispersed. And so we started talking about Chabad. And you find the Chabad movement located at many college campuses, and out here in the Pacific Northwest, we have them in the suburban areas. They're not full-blown synagogues, but they're Jewish community centers or resource centers. To what extent has Chabad tried to, in essence, become a more orthodox missionary movement to a Jewish community that's becoming increasingly assimilated or secular?
Well, it's interesting. Chabad has been very important in the last three or four decades especially, although I guess now it's four or five decades. When I talk about the Jewish experience in the context of immigration, as each generation becomes less Jewishly educated than the generation before, you begin to have young people know that they're Jewish but don't know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just don't have enough Jewish education or knowledge, I guess I should say, to know what that means. And some young people, that just means, well, Judaism is not part of my life any more than, you know, the fact that I live in New York is part of my life. And so I can marry somebody who doesn't live in New York and isn't Jewish. But for other people, you want to know about your roots. And we see a lot of this, young people who are seekers, they know that they had Jewish grandparents, and they want to know what that means and what that entails. And that's the group that Chabad started out trying to reach. They thought of themselves like missionaries to the Jews, only to Jews. They never tried to convert non-Jews to Judaism.
Right.
But they sought young Jewish people who did not know about what it meant to be Jewish, and to help them learn, they call it returning to Judaism. Now, that was the original concept, but the Lubavitch did, Chabad is the campus movement of the Lubavitch rabbi. The other thing that they did, they started being really out front about Jewish things. So at Christmas time, they would lobby to put a Hanukkah menorah in a public place next to the Christmas tree.
Mm-hmm.
You can sometimes see them at that time of year driving around with little Hanukkah menorahs on top of their cars.
Mm-hmm.
They had a bunch of trailers that were like mobile synagogues that they would park in shopping malls. And if you were Jewish man, they would invite you to come and say prayers with them. They would do a whole bunch of things, just really overt, very public, in order to raise consciousness that the Jews were here and that there were Jews out there that wanted to know what that meant.
I guess that could have a really important impact, again, as you know, perhaps the populations become more dispersed and intermingled with the Christian populations. Just knowing that somebody down the block or two blocks away is Jewish, you may have never known that before, or that there is a Jewish presence there, can have a huge impact in keeping you connected.
Well, I think the big impact was on all the movements. The Reform and the Conservative movement were affected by this, because up until this time, American Jews were very private about their religion. You did not flaunt your Judaism in public because you did not know who was anti-Semitic. You did not know who would hold it against you. You just didn't flaunt it. You separated your religious life from your public life. And what the Lubavitch demonstrated is that we didn't have to do that in America anymore. That it was no longer fashionable to be anti-Semitic in public,
right? Yeah.
And that we could be upfront and overt about our Jewish celebrations and our Jewish observances without worrying about it. We were secure enough in our Americanism to be able to handle that. And that's a sea change in American Jewish attitudes. And you saw, you see a lot of non-Jews are much more aware of Jews than they used to be,
mm-hmm.
Let's put it that way,
mm-hmm.
And aware of real Jews, not mythical Jews or you know, the scary mythology that the Jews are taking over the world. But you know that the Jewish people have a holiday at this time of year. You know what a Passover celebration is like because the grocery stores are full of Passover foods. There's just a lot of openness and that reflects a very high comfort level of American Jews with being Jewish, that when I was a child, you did not have that. That's part of the freedom of America. That's part of the promise of America. But it was really the Lubavitch rabbi and his Chabad movement that raised our consciousness that we could be Jewish and American without having any conflict.
Well, let me kind of finish off here as our podcast is coming to the close. One of the things you did in the book chapter that I have been referencing throughout our discussion here today is you speculated a little bit about the future of American Jewry. And if you could just share a few thoughts about in terms of the economic ideas that you've put forth here, what is the future of American Jewry?
Well, of course, I didn't come to any firm conclusions there. Certainly, Jewish education is stronger than it used to be, much stronger than it used to be, and Jews are the younger generation is much better Jewishly educated than the older generation, and that raises their comfort level with Judaism. And Judaism in America is experiencing what's called a renaissance. A lot of books being written, a lot of literature, a lot on the internet. The prediction is that the reform, that basically you're going to have two Judaisms rather than Reform, Conservative, Orthodox. There are now many different splinter groups from all of these, and the feeling is that 20 or 30 years from now, there'll basically be two streams of Judaism, the ultra-Orthodox and everybody else.
But within everybody else, there's, you know, and part of this is the American tradition, there's a strong sense of congregationalism.
Yes, very much so. And every congregation is different, and there's a lot of activity. At the same time, there's a lot of intermarriage, a lot of people that don't have much Jewish education and that really didn't have much Jewish content in their lives, even if their parents were Jewish. But many people are coming of age now and marrying who only had one Jewish parent and didn't have a whole lot of Jewish content in their lives. And so they're intermarrying also. Intermarriage is very important, and that is reducing the actual number of Jews in the next generation. So the prediction is that 30 years from now, the Jewish community will be smaller and more intense in its religious observance than it is today.
Well, since we don't have any hard ending points, I'm going to go ahead and insert one other question here, and this was also part of the chapter. Given the fact that in the United States, the Jewish population is a minority, but on the global scale, America is where one of the world's biggest Jewish populations is,
yes.
And add to that Israel. What impact do you think these changes and the changes that we've seen over the past several decades or generations is having on worldwide Jewry?
Well, they're really, actually, Israel has just as many Jews as the United States now. It's about evenly divided. And the impact on worldwide Jewry is tremendous. Not only that, but Israel has also developed its human capital, secular human capital, to the point where it's very close. It's clearly a highly developed country now, and which means that the wage rate of Israeli Jews is approaching that of American Jews. So there's been a convergence in many respects in the Jewish practice of Israel and the United States. The Israelis are not coming up with Reform and Conservative so much, but they're developing their own institutions that in many ways are analogous. The two countries will never have the same Jewish observance because when you're a majority, basically Israeli Jews have to do all the jobs in the economy and can't concentrate in a few occupations the way you can if you're a small minority. So there will always be a much greater wage dispersion in Israel and therefore a more dispersed Jewish practice. But Israel is a much smaller country, and so there's a concentration there that we don't have here. Israeli Jewry have a comparative advantage, to go back to the economic concepts, a comparative advantage in anything that has to do with the Hebrew language and literature, and anything that has to do with history and geography of the biblical lands. Whereas the American, the diaspora Jewry in general, but Americans as the by far dominant community in the diaspora, our culture is synagogue-based, and there's a lot of trading going back and forth, conceptually trading going back and forth. When Israelis want to learn about synagogues, they often learn from us, especially non-traditional synagogues. And when we want to learn Hebrew or Jewish history, we will turn to Israel to learn that. There's a lot of backing and forthing. Israelis come here to go to college and graduate school, and Americans go there for their Jewish education. There's a lot of mixing of the two populations. There's a lot of intermarriage between American Jews and Israeli Jews. So, you know, in some ways we are becoming we're merging into a new 21st century Judaism. And in other ways, there will always be differences between the two countries. One of the most important differences have to do with the politics. In the American political system is one in which there's religious pluralism, and we don't have political parties based on religion. Whereas in Israel, there are political parties that are religiously based. And that means that the extremes, either extremely orthodox or extremely secular, will always be much, much smaller in the United States Jewish community than they will be in the Israeli Jewish community.
Well, as a political scientist, I think I could spend another hour talking about this, but we are. I'm going to try to get Ken Wald, who recently wrote a paper on this, to come on to the podcast soon. So, Ken, if you're out there listening, I haven't called you yet, but would love to have you on the show. And I think we are pretty much out of time here today, so I want to thank you, Carmel Chiswick, for being on the show, and we look forward to what else you have to say in the future.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.